Hello from Patricia Glynn and Storycatcher. Simple stories, simply told. This is Potpourri, a monthly selection of short stories from the people of Southern Africa. I've collected them on the road. They're universal, they're everyday, and they're yours. The rain is making those noises on the canvas roof of my tent as I record this. Can you hear it? It's got to be one of the most enchanting sounds of my bush camp life. And it fills the gap left by the silence of the birds. They've taken cover under wing and branch because it does not stop raining. In fact, they've probably migrated. These are not the conditions in which to conjure up the blistering Southern Kalahari, but I relish them, frankly, after a trip that was more grueling than I remember the Kalahari to be. The daytime temperatures were a relentless head bashing in the late 30s, and there was a weekend when the thermometer hit 44 degrees, meaning, of course, that the temperature of the sand was even higher. Poor Tina. She jumped out of the car, took a few paces, and jumped straight back in because the superheated sand, of course, burnt the soles of her paws. So she spent the rest of the trip enjoying an air-conditioned car with the engine idling. I have to admit, I scuttled back to my air-conditioned little cottage in Askam in between recording my chats for this edition of Potpourri. It's a quaint little town, Askam, very interesting. And Brett Hoy, a local TV producer, and I cut a short movie about it, which will be up on my YouTube channel soon. The story of my involvement with the Kumani San is quite long and involved, so have a look at the More About Me page elsewhere on the website for that story. Essentially, it was about trying to preserve the memories of the old-timers of this community. Now, all but four of these amazing people are dead. In the space of 7 short years, they have succumbed to the ravages of poor nutrition, drug and alcohol abuse, and broken hearts, really. Witdraai, the farm where I spent most of my time down there, is all but devoid of elders. Two of them, healers Omar Anaboyane and Lace Kraper, carry most, but not all, most certainly, of the knowledge of their ancestors. They gave me a smear, which I'd never experienced before. It's a kind of deep and very relaxing massage in which the healers diagnose and treat ailments of a psychological or spiritual or physical nature. They picked up an injury of mine from nearly 40 years ago. I don't know how they did it. And a niggle in my neck. What they picked up of a psychological nature, they were kind enough to keep to themselves. There appears to be an explosion of very young girls on Witdraai with babies on their hips. One of my interviews in this edition is with a young woman who managed not to succumb to the traps that they've fallen into. Paulina Kraper was born in a grass hut with an outside kitchen and loo, no electricity, no running water, and no role models for the life she dreamed of. That life was being a chef in an upmarket hotel or restaurant. Today, she's a fully qualified chef working in an upmarket hotel near her birthplace. How she got there entailed a very long journey, a long and brave journey that she'll tell us about in one of the Potpourri interviews. What strikes you in the Southern Kalahari is that the environment is so harsh and so unforgiving that you need ingenuity and extremely hard work to survive there. Many of the farms in the area have been sold by a new generation that isn't prepared to slog away in the heat and the sand for little more than enough to put the kids through school and enjoy a brandy on the stoep as the sun goes down in spectacular fashion. Hans Knutzer has turned his hand to camel milk production to make a go of things, and his wife Elena has created a range of skincare products from their camel's milk. Have a listen to my chat with them and be prepared to be amazed by what goes on in a camel dairy. One of the highlights of my trip. I had to find an old farmer who hasn't sold up and left, and whose son has no intention of doing so either. And it turned out that there are only two of the original farm owners left in the Kuruman River area. We're going to sit on Willy Rousseau's metaphorical stoop and talk about what makes anyone want to stay in this extreme place. They're in the middle of a drought right now, the third year of drought in some places, the eighth in others, so I was told. Eight? Really? Seems hard to believe until you learn how it's affected the behaviour of one of the area's mammals. Don't miss that chat. Well, it's still raining. It's going to do so throughout this recording. So you're going to have pluck, 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 pluck. The large paper bark tree above my tent is stretching and flexing, and its sodden branches are drooping more and more towards my canvas roof. The sounds of the deluge are increasingly menacing. Pluck, pluck is swiftly becoming swish, swash, thunk. And it's not exactly conducive to sorry catcher productivity, but we must continue. For now, though, we're warm and dry, and I have some distraction in the form of two puppies romping around the tent. They leap from couch to bed and bed to couch, do a couple of laps around and under the furniture, followed by a teeth-bared tussle with sound effects provided by the little brindle girl and bear hugs by the little black boy. When they take the loo roll for a spin, I jump up and distract them by wiggling toys in front of their noses. Because of the rain, everything is covered in red paw prints. Tina has taken refuge on a chair near the front door from where she counts laps and intervenes if things get too boisterous. Rain, of course, is something these little dogs don't know because they're only a few months old and they're both from the Kalahari. Being cooped up is also something foreign to them because they were born on a farm in the sand dunes. I found them on my recent trip, but not by chance. It was a quest, and Nanette Fleming was critical to its success because she worked down there for 25 years and knows every sand bushman settlement in the area. Please take a listen to my Inspirations chat with her if you haven't done so already. It's such a heartfelt and honest account of her time with these complicated people. You might know from my social media posts that Tina and I were both in a deep state of depression after our Blitzy died recently. So I decided to go back to the place where both she and Blitz come from and try and find, if not a replacement, because he was truly a one in a million dog, but at least one with the same set of wonderful Kalahari Africanus genes. And because I was confident that I would know my next companion the minute I saw him or her, our visits to the various households and farms were pretty quick, until we arrived at the veranda where Deborah was giving everyone cheek and Gina was hiding under a bed to get away from the bullies of the pack. Deborah and Gina, I ask you, makes them sound like 1920s silent film stars. My vet says it makes them sound like porn stars. I'm happy to say I wouldn't know. Anyhow, I've renamed her Taka. She has chutzpah in spades, and she has the most unusual eyes. They're sherry-coloured. I also brought home dear little Gino because I think he needed to get away from the older dogs that were harassing him. I'll put some photos up on Facebook and on the blog page, which is where we're going to post these monthly introductions to the potpourri collections. People who live in extreme places are invariably people with strong personalities. And so it is with the folk I chatted to in this edition of Potpourri. I hope you enjoy it. Amazing Amy is the editor, along with our newbie, Frikkie Wallace. And David Lampkin is our editor-in-chief, as always. The word on everyone's lips down there in the Southern Kalahari is drought. So my portraits of the tough people I came across there must begin, I think, with someone who's seen several of them. Willy Rousseau is 75 years old and he's farmed in the wide sandy Kuruman riverbed for 50 years. He's one of only three of the original farmers left there. Willy's grandfather and father came here during the First World War when they were given grazing rights by the South African government. In return, the settlers were required to defend the boreholes that had been sunk into the massive aquifer that lies beneath the sand in this part of the Kalahari. And why did the boreholes need defending? Because Southwest Africa, now Namibia, was in German hands at the time. It's nearby, and getting access to the water would give the Germans a critical foothold in what was then British territory. So these were frontiersmen, meaning that Willy is descended from some pretty tough stock, made tougher by a life spent farming in pretty marginal and extreme conditions. In fact, the story of Willy's survival here lies in the fact that his father insisted that he get a university degree that he could fall back on when times were tough on the farm. You'll hear him mention, for instance, that he was working in Botswana at the time of one of the droughts. Let me just say, before we listen to Willy, I didn't stop our conversation by asking exactly where the places are that he mentions in his description of the retreating flow of the water down the riverbeds over the years, because you really don't need to know that in order to get the gist of what he's saying. And also, when we speak of him farming on the banks of the Kuruman River, you must not, please, imagine a blue stream of water flowing between lush banks. The southern Kalahari's riverbeds are wide, sandy, and completely dry, save for the few occasions when the rivers come down in flood. And the floods are dramatic, as you'll hear. But we'll start with the droughts that Willy has survived. When was the first?
It was in the mid-80s, 83 around about, and then...
For how long? How many years?
That one was about 3-4 years. You know, drought starts, it's not just... It's now dry. It starts raining a little bit less. And when you see it, then it's almost too late. So that was a learning curve for me, you know. You must watch out for things like this. If you get less rain, you must remember next year maybe also less. You must manage that. And in the mid-1990s, it was very dry.
How many years was that?
That was about 2 years. Two years, yeah. And then I can't remember, because I was in Botswana. I couldn't remember in the 2000s to 2000. It was dry, but it's not that it was a drought. So I think, of course, I can manage the things better. And I worked, you know, I didn't feel it so much. I can play off the work with the employment with Group 5 or whatever company I was with, the farming. And so, you know, I think you must do something like that to survive.
Many
can't, you know, and it's not always... I think most of the farmers think that you must be on the farm always. And I mean, I think it's like a business. You must manage it. You must have people you can trust. If you don't have that, then it's a problem.
Was there a drought then in the 2010s?
Yeah, I can't remember. I think it was in 2000, and I can't remember. I will lie if I say no. I can't remember which.
Yeah, you see, if it had had the same effect on you as it had on farmers who can't leave, who have no other skills, you, I would suggest, you'd know exactly what years the droughts were.
Yeah.
And the fact that you don't means that two things. One, that you worked elsewhere. And secondly, that you read the signs so well.
Yeah, you must read the signs. Otherwise, you're in trouble. And I mean, what happened now is that drought started 2 years ago. So we're in 2025, now 24. The rainy season, 24, we had only 26 millimeters of rain average. And in the 23 season, rainy season, we had only 56 millimeters of rain. So,
what should it be?
It should be 180 millimeters. That's enough for us, you know.
Okay, 50 odd isn't, and 20 odd definitely.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And then, but the years before that, the 22 and 21 season, we had over 300 millimeters of rain. Then I had cattle on the farm. I rented out for grazing for cattle. And that was a big mistake. Cattle needs a lot of food, and that's the thing. But many people will differ from me, but that's my opinion. I've learned my lesson. I'm 75 years old now. And
you've been farming for 50
years? Yeah, yeah.
So you've learned a few tricks in
that. Yeah, this, yeah, but you never learn enough.
So I just want to understand. So you see this drop-off in the rainfall, and then you begin working right ahead for the next year, and then maybe 2 years, by reducing whatever's on the farm.
Yeah, I can do that, or you can do the other way around. I've got still called my original farm, you know, from my father's time, and I bought a little bit extra. An average farm in the Kalahari mustn't be smaller than, in my opinion. In the old days, was people can farm on 5,000 hectares, but it's not viable anymore. Later on, I thought 8,000 is the right. I think it's going up 10,000. I don't know why.
That was my next question. Why was it viable at 5,000?
I think the cost of farming was lower at that stage. You know, your
labor
and fuel and your farming equipment like 4x4, all that stuff. The margin was bigger between your income and your expenses. Now it's a problem. The margins go smaller and smaller and smaller, and that's a problem.
So why do you stay? Why do you do this?
Because it's your life. It's inheritance. It's my life here. I don't want, if I can just survive, I don't want to be, you know, drive the best motor vehicle or whatever, or have to go and flash your holidays or whatever. That's a way of life here. You're born and bred here. So that's the thing. It's in your blood that you can't do anything about it. I can't sell the farm. Just go and stay in Cape Town or whatever. I won't make it.
Well, it's great that you've got a son who wants to farm, because that's often a problem nowadays.
Well, it is definitely a problem, and it's a difficult world to see. Now it's the heat and...
tell me about the heat. Isn't your impression it's getting hotter here in the Kalahari?
I think so. You can feel it, yeah. I don't know. It's not a climate change, I suppose. What can you do about it?
What about the sheep? Don't they feel it?
Yeah, they feel it, definitely. That's why this area is especially very sought-after type of farms in the riverbeds, you know. You've got lots of trees, and it goes far into the veld, say about 3/4 of the veld, and they lie under the shade and so on. So in the mid-Kalahari, there's not a lot of trees. You know, they survive.
Yeah, they will survive. It doesn't mean to say they're comfortable. True. I've heard that there are 800-year-old kameeldoorn, camel thorns, dying in the drought. Have you heard that?
No. My theory is totally something different. They don't die of drought. Definitely not. But I think what happens is if you go past Vidrai and you go down to Nunipit, then you see a lot of trees die. Mm. But the problem there is this river, this Kuruman River, the first time it came down, I think it was in 1899, somewhere around there. And then in 1922, I think, when my father, they was already here, it came down. And then 50 years later, 1974, it came again.
And when it comes down, how big is it?
It's big. It's big. I mean, in 74, my father's house was totally took away. There was nothing left almost, you know.
Wow.
It was, and it went to almost to Nunipit so far.
What, the house?
No, the water. The water of the river. And that's my point. Because the rivers are not coming down anymore.
Okay.
That's why the camel thorn trees die.
Are dying.
They're definitely not of drought.
So you've lost a house. What other natural disasters have you had on the farm?
No, but no other natural disasters, just a drought and the flood from the river, and no other.
Didn't you say you lost a second house?
Yeah, this is in 76. The river came down again, and I rebuilt the house, and my wife and I just moved in, and the river came down and took it away again. And then I built another house. So this
further up the bank.
Yeah, yeah. And I just, well, it came down a lot in 88. It came down and was in 94, 5, around about there, I think. And then it came down again here and once 2 years back, 3 years back about. But it doesn't go any further enough.
As far as it used to.
It used to go. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. How is all of this farming and the challenges and the hardships, how has that changed you? What sort of person has it made you into?
Yeah, when I started farming, I was a youngster of 26. You know, it was all glory and, yeah, it was nice to farm. Your father made the decisions and then you grow into it and you said, well, I'll try something. Then I bought the farm and then it starts to drought. Now it's your decision. What must I do now? What must I do to survive, to keep the farm? You must have the love of the farm to survive here. Otherwise, you can just sell and go off. You must have faith, one thing, and you must also have guts and you must have patience. I said to my son, Jan, you must have patience. You mustn't start worrying too early. You must wait. You must wait. You mustn't be greedy. You must wait till the rain will come. That's not easy to do it. It's very hard.
I would think you'd have to have quite a solid marriage.
Definitely. You must have a wife that understands the problems and the hardship to get everything done. And, you know, you don't have all the flashy things in life. You can't go to theaters. You can't go to holidays every year or whatever. You know, in the town, in December when it's very hot, then you must be on the farm. You can't go and lie on the beach in Durban or Cape Town. So, yeah, you must have a wife that understands everything and support you. And you must also support your wife. And then you must read the kids. They must understand that also. There's no money. If you tell them there's no money for this and for that, then there is no money. You must have a wife. You must have kids that understand these things. I don't have to have an airplane or the best Land Cruiser or whatever. I can survive in the Mahindra. Yeah. I don't worry about things like that. Yeah. As long as I can have my farm and my family from all of South Africa come and visit the farm. This farm is for them a haven.
That it is. That it certainly is. And it seems there are so many dwellings for the extended Rousseau family. It's like South Fork in the dunes. I'm exaggerating, of course. Willie Rousseau, farmer of 50 years near Askam and a pillar of the local community. A man of much the same age as Willie Rousseau, but with vastly different experience of farming, is Johannes Titties. In the days before there were fences between the farms in the Andriesvale-Askam area, Johannes Titties and his father used to trek with their white employer's sheep, moving them around to good grazing. The young man learned how to track predators, such as caracal and jackal, because if a sheep went astray, not only would nothing be found of it the next day, except a few bones, but Johannes would be in deep trouble. But in 1994, everything changed, and his people won a land claim against the government. Johannes was among those who were granted their own farms, or portions of a farm, and so began his life as a farmer of his own sheep on his own land. Unfortunately, that has only made the predation on the herd even harder to bear.
That's what they liked it was.
Yes, it's much more devastating in these days, because we don't have big herds. Yes, it's our own land. Yes, it's our own sheep. But we don't have big herds. So actually, the damage that a predator does is much more hurtful to us. But because I'm so good at what I do, and I've got so much knowledge over the years, when I see a track of a predator, I won't stop. I will carry on, even if I go into the white farmer's veld, because I'm not just helping myself and my herd, I'm helping everybody farming in the area. And to my luck or my detriment, I am now renowned for being able to do it. So while I'm still with one farmer and helping him with one of the predators that have now become sort of tame with the herd and is helping themselves, another farmer will phone me and say, listen, you know, I have a problem with this predator here. So now I'm being kept busy by everybody to keep the predators at bay.
And is this the first time that the predators have changed? In other words, is this the first time that the drought has been so bad that other animals, apart from caracals, are coming in?
Last year is the first time I heard of the warthogs that were killing lambs. I first didn't believe it until a farmer from Posmansberg showed me the photographs. He's got a big herd of goats, and the goats were having kids, but he wasn't seeing them. And when he started investigating, he found 15 warthogs, and he shot them, and out of the 15, 13 warthogs had kids in their stomach. And he realized it was a problem. People here didn't realize, because they didn't want to kill the animals, because warthogs are also nice animals and are pretty animals, but it's now gone so bad. So what everybody is saying in the area is it's because of the drought, and they have spoken to people that said if they have nothing to eat, this is what will happen. It's not an easy predator to kill. It's dangerous. He nearly lost a dog, one of his best dogs. It got the warthog's teeth went just either side of the hips. Fortunately, didn't get to any organs, so he could pull the dog through. But it's much more dangerous to hunt them than any of the other predators.
Dit is om net wanneer hulle nie die hulle kry nie kos genoeg hoe dan moet hulle nou maar by die diere oplop.
But what do you do, Om Janus, if the warthogs are actually on a kill, if they're eating a lamb? How do you deal with that?
Ek het hom nou nog nie op hom so afgekom.
I haven't seen that. It hasn't happened to me that I've caught them in the act. We can only, when we slaughter them, see that they have been eating lambs. But we haven't sort of got to that scenario.
So they actually hunt them in their burrows or whatever. How do they hunt them?
Yeah. We take their spoor, and you would want a fresh spoor, and they love going into the art fox holes. They don't go head first, they reverse in. It's not difficult to get them out, because they don't like a lot of activity around the hole when they're in there. So you can get them out.
Induce them out, you don't pull them out.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
They will come out. It's then you've got to be awake. It's not that easy, because they're dangerous and you've got to get to them quickly.
And I've seen footage of Umtitis or someone holding onto their horns, which is incredibly
dangerous. Onto their teeth.
Teeth. Incredibly dangerous.
The warthog was already stunned. I was just holding the head so that we could give the final blow.
It's worth emphasizing that you have no weapons, no guns. You do this all with a kiri, a knob kiri. Did you used to hunt caracal like that?
Kroikat. Just with the kiri. The dogs help. The dogs catch it, and we just come in and give the final blow.
Isn't it easiest to get to the youngsters
the piglets and eat, kill those, because then you reduce the population.
Maar nou is dit so moeilik om die kleintjies in die hande te kry. En jy kan nie maklik.
It's extremely difficult to get to the warthogs young. The mother hides them very well. She will also be very aggressive. So it's not easy to get to the young. But there's a farmer, Barry Knutson, that tamed caracal, and he's got two tamed caracals. So we stopped off there, and the men on the bucky didn't realize they were his pets. And the instant reaction of the caracals being around there was enormous, until he stopped them and said, no, please, the caracal's in my house, it's my pet. So please don't hurt.
So Umtiti's, is your flock okay? Is it on the rise, fall?
At this stage, a few years ago, I got a bit sick and I have heart problems. So I sold my entire herd of livestock. And I want to start again because I couldn't get to them. But I want to start again, but I'll wait for the drought to pass.
I mean, what amazing, amazing synchronicity. Well, how clever did he know it was coming?
So sierlijk gebeurd. Hij heeft voor ons inslag gezet. Die oom heeft voor ons opleiding gekregen.
There was somebody that was giving training on game farms and guides and how to do this game farming and how to process meat and so forth. And they did warn us that this drought was going to come. And in that, the start of the drought, I got so terribly, terribly ill. So that's how the synchronicity happened between my herds and the drought.
Johannes Titties with the simply astounding story about warthog being driven to hunting and eating lambs by the dreadful drought in the southern Kalahari. It's been one of my life's privileges to have the Sand Bushman ladies cook bread for me on a red sand dune in the middle of nowhere. So little is required to make something utterly delicious. Just flour, yeast, salt, pepper, and warm water. Oh, and years of practice, of course. You see, they bake the bread in an oven they create in a hole beneath the sand. Far be it from me to tell you how it's done, but it's a refined art, I can assure you. They tap the sand to hear if the loaf is ready, and when it comes out, they brush it off and there isn't a grain of sand left on it. There's also not a crumb of bread left when you finish eating it. My next chat is with the daughter of one of those Sand Bushman women, and although she knows how to cook a loaf of bread beneath the sand, she also knows how to cook it and a whole lot of other things in an electric oven. You see, Paulina Kraper is a chef, and her journey from using her mother's type of oven to those in a modern commercial kitchen is as interesting as it is admirable. And she'll be the first to say that her success would not have been possible without two philanthropists, Sharon White and her husband, Reinhold Jost.
At first, I went to Rietfontein to start my grade 8 year there, but then the children there were awful, they bullied me.
Because you were Sand Bushman?
Yes, and I was very tiny. There's one school holidays when I came back from school, I just told my dad that I'm not going back to school if I can't go to another place. And then they tried to talk to Auntie Sharon and just ask her, how will she take it if I want to go to Joburg and do my school there? Auntie Sharon, in the beginning, she was not sure if we will cope. But then me and my brother, J.D. Kraper, also went with me. And then we started grade 8 there. And we finished matric that side.
Hang on a minute. Were you at a good standard at grade 8? Or yes. Did you struggle?
I had to redo grade 8 because the grades weren't that good and the marks weren't that good. So I started grade 8 there in Joburg with all the support, like from the teachers, Auntie Sharon and Uncle Reinhold. I got through grade 8 up until matric. I passed with the university entrance in matric. And after that, I told Auntie Sharon that I don't want to come to Welkom until I finish my...
Welkom being the settlement here.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Until I finish my whole studies. And I didn't want to end up like the other people in Welkom where I grew up. Just sitting there and doing nothing. I want to do something with my life. So we decided to go and look at a college. So I went to Potch to study a chef, to be a chef.
Where did this idea come from that you wanted to be a chef?
No, I've always wanted to be a chef. Like from the start, I just loved cooking. And I wanted to be a chef. We had a thing where you had to put your dreams inside when we were in grade 8. And mine was to be a chef. Up until then, I just built up my confidence like in being a chef. And I taught myself the things that I didn't know. I used to and still do read out of the recipe books, just looking at new ideas and just go for it. If I get a chance to buy something, then I buy it and make something.
So yeah, you would read a recipe book like I would read a novel when I'm going to sleep.
Yes.
You just like reading them, like literature.
Yes.
Yeah. And you were practicing from tiny to feed your family.
Yes. Because my mother, they used to go to the farm and then they would leave me, like with my brothers at the house alone. And now I'm the responsible one to make food for them and to look after them and make sure they are fed, yeah.
And it wouldn't have been very fancy food because you didn't have the money for that. Did you develop ways of being clever with little?
Yeah, like sometimes we will make like a steamed bread in a pot on a fire and then we'll make like a lentil soup or... We will slaughter like one of the sheep and then we'll use the meat to make like a curry pot or... But sometimes we'll eat like rice with meat or just rice and make something to go with it or spaghetti. Yeah.
So it was sort of meat at the beginning of the month.
Yes.
And then towards the end of the month you had to be very clever with your steamed bread.
Or the asprot that you make under the hot ash and sand. Yeah, we used to have that. Eat it with the fat of the sheep that has been dried out into the fire. The flavorings were just salt and pepper to make it like a spread, like almost like butter to spread on the...
Okay, so bread. Take me through this. It was the sheep fat that was melted on the fire into a pot or something.
Into a pot.
Uh-huh.
And then you just flavor it with the salt and pepper. It stalls, almost like a butter. It forms.
Okay. Yeah, okay. It firms and hardens.
Yeah.
And then will it last for a good while?
Yeah, it lasts us like 2 weeks or 3 weeks. It depends on... We're not eating it every day. We don't eat bread. We won't eat bread every day with the fat. When we slaughter the sheep, we will take the sheep head and
the forearm.
Yeah, the forearms, and we will skin it off and make a curry out of it, or we just bake it in the oven or in the pot, or you cook it with some onions and potatoes to make a nice curry.
So you were slaughtering from very young?
Yeah.
And you had no problem with that?
No. I used to be scared, but my father taught me like one day when my brothers are not around and I'm the only one at the house, I will have to do that. So I just took on the challenge.
He taught you how to do it quickly?
Yeah.
You're a brave girl. You're a brave girl. And your father was also renowned in the veld. He was a really outstanding tracker, hunter, herbalist, everything. So what about wild meat? What about game? Can you cook that?
Yes, my older brother taught me a nice way of making a steenbok. Mm-hmm. The steenbok meat. He makes Kentucky out of the meat.
What does that mean, he makes Kentucky?
Like, he would take a piece of meat off, and then he would hammer it like flat, and on the side he will have an egg in like one bowl, and the other bowl he will have like flour that's mixed with spices.
And you give it a proper batter.
Yes.
And there you have it.
And sometimes we'll make, I'm not sure like what's the English word, but tompis. It's when you cook the meat until it falls off the bone and then it's like flaky. Then you just add the spices, the onions, and some oil. That's it. With your roasted bread.
Mm. Okay, I can understand that being delicious.
Yes.
Could you hunt a steenbok?
No.
No, that's an art form.
Yes.
So where do you feel you need to develop as a chef?
I still have a lot to learn. I know like all of my basics, but there's some points you need to practice more in like order to get your things the right way, like you want it. When you make something in the kitchen, it's not for you that you're making it. It's for the guest, and you must make sure the guests can eat it with their eyes as well as with their mouth.
What about coming back to Welkom? Is it your decision to stay there? Because I would have thought that it would be quite a small, inhibiting kind of place, squeezing kind of place after the big city.
It wasn't my idea to come back, but like after my dad died, everything just fell apart. So I had to come back to stand by my mother and like help her with the kids. But I also got the opportunity to go back to the city and work there. After this month, on the 1st, I'm starting my new job at Kwatu.
Okay.
It is, I'm not sure if you know where that is.
Yes, it's in the Western Cape.
Yes.
It's a sand bushman place in
yes.
Kwatu. Yeah, it's where tourists come to see sand bushman paintings and dance and all of that. Yeah, that's great. Getting out again. You can always come back, but the possibility of leaving is going to get less and less and less if you don't jump now.
Now.
Yeah.
Yeah, you must grab every opportunity that you get. You must just grab it with full hands. And don't stand back. Let's just take it.
Quite right, Paulina Kraper, quite right. I filmed Paulina making roosterkoek in one of the lovely chalets at the Kalahari Lodge, and we'll have that video up on my YouTube channel as soon as we can. Thank you, SJ, who's the owner of the lodge, for providing us with the chalet and a super kitchen to work in. Not that we needed the oven, because we tried out the Ramoska countertop oven that I'm experimenting with, and the rolls came out perfectly. And so to one of the most famous farms of the Southern Kalahari, where the sound effects are nothing like these. It's boring with rain here in the Magaliesberg. Anyhow, this famous farm in the Southern Kalahari is called Koppies Kraal, and for many years it was believed to be the location of the lost city of the Kalahari. That's thanks to Guillermo Farini, a.k.a. William Leonard Hunt, who said he saw the ruins of an ancient and huge settlement here in 1885. And because people weren't travelling to and from the Kalahari like we do today, he got away with the big hoax for years and years. And when subsequent seekers didn't find the lost city here, they thought it must be elsewhere, and hence the endless quest for this mythical place. I was given a tour of the iconic rocks by the current owner of Koppies Kraal, Hans Knutzer. But I wasn't there for the lost city. I was there for something far closer to my heart, his camels. Now, camels have played a big part in the development of this part of the Kalahari. They've been both beasts of war and peace in these parts because they're so suited to the weather and terrain. Camels have been used to patrol borders, to track down poachers and insurgents, and transport goods to isolated camps. And they've been especially useful in the management of the national park, nowadays called the Kalahari Transfrontier Park. In the 1950s, the park's camels were auctioned off. Hans's grandfather bought them, put them on his farm, and, well, sort of left them to their own devices. They flourished, of course, because they're ideally suited to the vegetation and landscape, as I said. Fast forward to the early 2000s, and Hans decided to have a go at camel dairy. He now has 100 females, of which a third to a half are being milked at any one time. As you'll hear, the big difference between this and cow dairies is that in order for a camel to continue producing milk, it has to know that its calf is alive. So one of the advantages that camel milk has over cow's milk is that it is regarded as more humanely produced. All good and well, but how do you run a dairy using animals that are as bad-tempered as they are smelly?
I think in South Africa we have the problem that we only know camels from what we see in movies and the few that we get to do with us riding camels at certain touristy places. But for the dairy industry, we need to get that camel to completely trust us. So the way you treat that camel is completely different. No force can ever get you any milk from a camel. Your approach is different. And you'll see when we meet them that some of them are actually quite attached to humans. They want the attention. They love the attention.
What induces them back to the dairy?
When the calf is about 4 months old, we then separate them from their mums during the day, and they go into a separate area during the day. And the mums would normally come back in the evenings, but if they don't, like this evening, we would send someone to fetch them. The one thing about camels is they can go, we sometimes, depending on the vegetation available, would take them as far as 4 or 5 kilometers from the household during the day in the mornings, and then just go and fetch them again and bring them back for the milking session. So if you hold back the small calves as well, which we've done in the past, then the mums would come back automatically for the small calves. But we've stopped that practice. If a calf is less than 4 months old, he goes out with his mum. So the enticement is less. The motivation to come back is less. Even for the camels with 4 month old calves, they're not so concerned about a calf anymore. So then we send someone out to fetch them.
And what do you do with the calves during the day?
They go into a separate, what we call a camp, and they start eating from at least, I would say, 2 to 3 weeks old. So by the time they're 4 months old, they eat, they live off greenery, whatever is available in the field.
And has a camel got four teats?
Yes.
And do you milk it exactly like a cow?
Yeah, but we milk with a machine, yes, not by hand.
What? They stand there while you put a machine
on
them?
Well, they tame. You need to teach them to be, it's patience. It's all about patience, and you spend time with them, and eventually they allow you to milk them. You only have about, with our camels, about 2.5 to 3 minutes to extract the milk. So that's not enough time to do it by hand. So you connect the machine milker. In the meantime, you get the other one ready, the next mummy ready with her calf. And when she's ready, she's laid down the milk, and this one would be finished, and you can just swap over the machine to the other one.
And the calf is waiting now. You've left some milk for the calf.
Yes, yeah. I don't know the exact physiology of the camel, but what I do know is that they have a valve system in there. If they decide that's enough milk now for the machine, it'll just shut it off. And there's nothing you can do to get the rest. And she will walk out from there, and you will see her just lay down the milk for the calf again.
Bright chicks, you see. Very bright, bright chicks. All right, and they've all got different yields, I'm sure. You know, some.
Yes,
more.
Well, we don't measure per cow. It's, I think the technology to do per cow is just not there for us. Well, we don't
prepared to invest that money for it. We just measure the herd as a whole. And then the other thing is our camels, because of the history and where they come from, they were never bred for milk production. They were for riding purposes and other work. We don't have a high yield. We average about 3 liters a day, and that's on 2 milking sessions, so it's not a lot. But some of them would obviously deliver much less or produce much less, and others would produce a bit more. But we're still building the herd, so we just made the decision to rather keep the females, all of them, and not do too much of a selection.
The genetics are not sort of closely monitored. You're not doing that kind of analysis.
No, not yet. And we've had problems with deformities. And we initially didn't pick up on it because we didn't know enough about camels until they sort of realized that that must be to do with inbreeding. And then we started bringing in bulls from just... We still can't bring in camels from outside of the country. But there are camels spread throughout South Africa in small herds and small groups, and we were able to pick up a few and brought in bulls from there.
And the deformities have stopped?
Completely.
Yeah, this is what's so interesting about it. It's a new science. You're a pioneer in a whole lot of things.
For us, certainly. Obviously, camels are definitely not a new species to breed with, not a new species to milk or anything. There's a lot of science out there. There's a lot of people that know a lot about camels, but not really in South Africa. I'm fortunate that I built up a connection with people in the UAE, actually a Pakistani, who is involved in one of the dairies in the UAE, and he's been very willing to share a lot of information. So that's been very good.
Tell me about the milk, because it apparently has extraordinary components. And, of course, this component that makes it so interesting in the treatment of autism.
In terms of the comparison to cow's milk, there are two proteins in cow's milk that causes allergic reactions. The one is a protein that sits in the casein, which is basically the solids of the milk, and the other one is a protein that sits in the whey, the watery part of the milk. So it's very hard for, let's say, scientists to remove those proteins from those components of cow's milk. But we're fortunate that in camel's milk, both those proteins are absent. The biggest market for camel milk is actually in the, let's call it, the people that react to cow's milk market. That they will not, it's quite likely that they will not react to the camel's milk. Lactose, often a question we get, what about the lactose? Is there lactose in there? Lactose is milk sugar, and there's lactose in all types of milks. But there is a difference in the digestibility of the milk, of the lactose. And the lactose in camel's milk, again, is easier to digest than in cow's milk. The question about autism, apparently lactoferrin. Now, let me leave the apparently out. Lactoferrin is associated with immunity or higher immunity. And camel milk is high in lactoferrin. So that is why... I think that in terms of the autism side, a lot of those children are struggling with immunity issues or digestion issues. Now, the camel milk helps on two fronts. We do the raw camel milk. We also do the powdered camel milk. They both contain the lactoferrin component. But they also contribute to the microbe, basically resetting the microbes in the gut, which helps with better nutrient uptake, which again is linked to better brain function. And that helps with, for those children. So the obvious, I wouldn't say the result, but the observation that parents would obviously come back with is that we see less erratic behavior. We see a calmer child. The child is responding differently from what it was before it used the milk.
And what about anecdotal evidence? You presumably drink it every day?
We use camel milk as you would use normal milk. There is a particular taste to cow's milk that once you've become accustomed to camel's milk, you don't like the cow's milk anymore. You tend to then favor the camel's milk and how it reacts in, for instance, coffee or tea or any of the drinks that you make.
And can you make yogurt with it?
No.
No.
Interestingly enough, not. They've not been successful in making proper thick-set yogurt. They get something that they would call almost like a drinking yogurt, but it's not yogurt as we know it that you buy in the shop. Ice cream, yes, but not yogurt.
And what else? Cheese?
Yes. We started off here, and because we were fairly isolated, we thought, okay, let's make cheese. That'd be the easiest thing to do. But it turned out to be quite difficult. I think the technology has advanced, and there are people with a lot more knowledge about making cheese that has been successful with it. Again, not in South Africa, in the Middle East. And most often it's soft cheeses. The Arab culture is also more geared towards soft cheeses than hard cheeses. But they've started to do your harder cheeses for the European market.
Are you exporting anywhere?
No, we don't. Certainly not on the milk powder and even the, well, fresh milk you can't export. But our fresh milk is, anyway, is unpasteurized. The powder side, we just don't have the volumes yet. We need many, many more tons of milk to be able to export. Interestingly enough, they use powdered milk in baby formula because of these anti-allergenic properties. But we can't export that. So the big hope and idea for us would be on the skincare range.
So the big hope lies then with Eleanor's products. I asked her first how the idea came about.
Well, in 2020, we were all on the farm, and Hans kept asking me, is there something that we could do other than just sell milk for milk? And we investigated looking at soap, and I started playing around with soap in the kitchen, as most people do. Managed to make soap, and then we started having tour groups on the farm who started buying the soap, and then people started asking, but couldn't we do something else? And that's where it started.
But you're not a chemist, so,
no, so
how did you develop the recipes?
We engaged the services of various people, so chemists along the way.
And did you contact some sort of Arab princesses and find out what they were slapping on themselves?
We did not. Everything was just from what I thought might be a good idea next.
Well, have they been ordering them from, I don't know, UAE or somewhere?
So we've had inquiries, but it's quite a long process to export anything, so we're not there yet. But we have had inquiries from Saudi, as it turns out.
Yeah. When you've done your homework, you know what's available there, presumably.
Mm. Not as much as one would think. So this year we hope to be attending some trade shows overseas to showcase our products. So that would be our first step into the overseas market.
Are these trade shows specifically for camel milk products?
No, they're specifically for skincare and health products.
Okay. Yeah. Yes, I'm sure it's of interest to the health people who are, by extension, interested in cruelty and cruelty matters, that you are developing a product which comes from a non-cruel source.
Yes, although we have no accreditation as yet, we can say that our products are ethically produced, ethically sourced, ethically produced.
Yeah. Mm. 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 So great interest, I think, and I don't think a lot of people know about it because I'm very much in that sort of area of interest.
So it's
I haven't heard of it.
No, it's a growing market.
And you were here on the farm with a pot on the stove.
Quite literally.
Making your butter. Yeah?
The butter, no. Not the body butters and the creams. Those came a little bit later. So it was primarily the soap to start off with. Batches and batches of soap.
And some of it didn't work in the beginning.
Oh, Hans had to bury many of my mishaps because they stink when they don't work.
What, because the milk goes sour?
No, because of the chemical reactions between the caustic soda and everything else that you put in there causes a chemical reaction. And that chemical reaction, if you're not doing it properly, stinks. But if you do it well, it just turns into beautiful soap.
And then that was just exported to a factory somewhere.
So the soap we make down in Somerset West ourselves in our own facility, all the other products are produced in a factory.
Where lies your competition?
It's an interesting question. So there's a lady, a South African lady, who moved to Dubai, who started the Camel Soap, I think it's called the Camel Soap Company, in Dubai. So she makes soap there, big scale, very big scale exports, and she's brought her products back to South Africa. But she focuses more on soap. She has a few other things, but more on the soap. In terms of competition, none. Unless you want to compare me to people who do goat's milk or donkey milk. But it's not the same thing at the end of the day.
No, that's the thing. It's got such cachet. Camel milk.
It's its own thing.
Yeah.
And people say once they've bought it, they don't buy anything else again.
Well, I'll let you know. You just give me a reject here. It's quite enough, and I'll give you
I'll give you
feedback. And the feedback is that I tried the milk and I loved it. I tried the hand cream and I loved it. And most of all, I loved the camels. Have a look at our wee Facebook movie about my time in the dairy. Hans and Elena Knutzer on their farm Koppieskraal. Their milk is called Camel Milk South Africa, and Elena's skincare range goes under the name AfriQueen. The packaging is an elegant combination of black and gold. That's it for this month's edition from the Southern Kalahari. Do let me have your feedback on the stories we brought you. I'll be setting off for Botswana soon, and I'd love my route there to be determined by your stories and where they lie. And if you're in any doubt as to the kind of stories we're after, have a look at our website, storycatcher.co.za. My team is small and dedicated and comprises Amy Moss, Frikkie Wallace, and David Lamkin. Thank you, guys.